Gosh, you guys, and I haven't even said a word. I want to take you with me all the time. Can I just put you in my back pocket? So when I start to feel down and lonely, happens a lot when you're doing this kind of work. So actually, this image will stay with me because I need it. It's actually not so funny, but I get why you want to laugh, because it's like, let's break the ice. But it's really an intense time out there, which is why I really want to thank Patrick Lannan and the Lannan Foundation for having me here today in this place with all of you. Patrick, thank you so much. It really means the world to me to be able to be here, because it means that I feel like I have a community. And community is really, really super important. The fact is that I spend a lot of my time getting from one place to another. So my community becomes my crew, whoever I'm working with at that particular time, and it's my family. But when I'm out and about, I don't have you with me in the back of my pocket, although I kind of like that image, so I think I'm going to keep it with me. But, you know, the essence of community is so important because it changes everything when you have human contact. It changes our minds. We no longer feel like this person is less than human because at this point you have made a contact with them. And community does just that. It allows you to feel bonded to a fellow human being. The enemy becomes less your enemy once you have touched this person. And this person has felt your touch. And that's why, really, I touch everyone who I interview, except for when I'm not allowed. And it has happened. It's been a little weird, but I've completely pulled back. But I have to respect that there are traditions where that is not allowed. But I do touch, because I do think that there's something that happens in that moment. And you're probably wondering now, why is she talking about humanity and touching people? I thought she was going to talk about immigration and the border. What is she talking about? Because actually, my friends, mis queridos amigos, I am in a state of shock. But I can only tell you a little bit about what I have seen, because I am in the midst of it. And so there's only so much that I can reveal. There are stories that I will tell you about, stuff that is coming up, like right now, this week, on Latino USA. We'll have a very big, special half-hour documentary about the Dominican Republic, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. We have a piece coming up on Need to Know, also about the Dominican Republic, and actually the same issue that I'll be talking about here, which is deportations and detentions of the other. In this case, Dominicans deporting Haitians. Yeah, it's very ugly. But I am actually deep, deep in a frontline documentary. As far as I know, I'm the first Latina to anchor a frontline documentary, so I am really... It took a long time, but I was not gonna give up. I was just not going to give up, and thankfully, I'm there, and I'm working with, you know, the most serious, top-notch investigative crew in the country, and in, you know, parts of the world, so I'm really honored. It is a documentary about immigrant detention centers and policies leading up to that. So that's a little bit about where I've been. I'm going to get to that in a second. But, you know, like you, every day I wake up and I check the headlines, whether it's, you know, on the web or real paper or Twitter or Facebook. I know, I could never imagine that I would be saying I check headlines on Twitter. Oh, my God, what has happened to me? But, you know, I check these headlines and I'm just like, what is happening in this world? What is happening in our world? How is this possible? And while I know that there's a way of looking at what's happening in our world as this extraordinary bubbling up of democracy and of voice and of wanting voice, I think what I'm more freaked out about is the reactions to that. And specifically in our country, you know, what our president has done. So, you know, I I just can't kind of, well, actually, wait, that comes up later. I was almost going to tell you, but it's in later in my speech, so hold on. The thing is that I actually do often see my reality as half empty. I wish I was that kind of like, no, it's half full, really, it's half full. But these days, the reality is that I do tend to see it half empty. And there is a separate conversation to be had about women and about Latinas and about depression. Latina teenagers have the highest rate of attempted suicide in our country. Latina teens have the highest rate of attempted suicide in our country. They do not complete, but they have the highest rate of attempted, which is, of course, a yearning to be heard. Thankfully, I am not clinically depressed. My cure is that I work out, I run, I have music with me wherever, and now today I bought my candle. Oh, and I have my fetish. Yes! I have my fetish. It's in my bag. I'm so happy. Thank you, Laureen, wherever you are. I'm so happy. I like put it on my Facebook and tweet it. I have fetishes for my whole family, and they're just like, what? I'm like, zoomy. It's really, really cool. But I'm not depressed. I work out, like I said, and I do kickboxing, and I lift weights. So that keeps me settled, and I communicate with nature. And I have an amazing husband and kids. But there is absolutely reason to be depressed. Just reading the paper yesterday, there's a story that I can't get out of my mind. It was a little tiny blip in the paper, in the Times, actually, the hard copy, because I was reading it in the paper, in the plane, you know, that 16-hour plane ride from New York to here. I want a direct flight, please, New York, Albuquerque, please. It was a story about a massacre in a village in the Ivory Coast. And they were saying, maybe 150 people, but human rights workers were saying more like 300. And they just walked in and there were bodies everywhere, and bodies of children and bodies of women and bodies of men. And I just, them thinking about the terror that they must have felt. And then I think about Rwanda, where I was, and Nairobi, where I was, also with these images of horror. And I was thinking about what is it about human beings that we can do this to one another? And it comes back to where I started, which I'm really glad, I'm sure you're really glad that I found my way to get back to where I started, which was about humanity, community, touching, seeing someone, seeing yourself and the person most unlike you, being able to really identify with that person who couldn't be more different than you. And the fact is that when you don't have that, then you dehumanize. You dehumanize. And once you dehumanize, then that's it, basically. Anything can happen. Anywhere. Because these people, this group, is less than human, is so different than me that there's nothing I share with them at all. So that leads me to a scenario that I'm going to paint for you, and I am going to ask you to tell me where you think, what country you think I'm describing. You are detained. While you are detained, you are fed food that has maggots in it. There is a complaint box, but it is locked. You have to use the toilets in public. There are no partitions. There are 5 toilets just right next to each other. There's a wall there, and then there are 5 shower heads. So no partitions, and you basically have to use the toilet and shower with strangers in public. You do not have access to a lawyer or a judge by law. In other words, you are not guaranteed that by law. you can be held with no option to plead your case. You are held mandatorily by law. Mandatorily detained. You are not allowed to post bail or bond at all. You are not promised a phone call. You might get it or you might not, but it's not promised to you. You might be sexually assaulted by a guard while you are in a room sleeping with 50 strangers. And you will be told that sleeping with 50 strangers like this in a public space with bunks is actually good for your socialization. You don't have windows. The windows that do exist actually are cordoned off, and you cannot get close to them. The closest you can get is about 3 feet. You can go for days without seeing sunlight. There is no way for you to demand having sunlight. It will really just depend up to the guards. You might even be sent to a foreign country by mistake. And it would be the mistake of the government of this country that I'm describing for you. And they would have to go and get you and bring you back because they sent you someplace by mistake. You are not, in fact, a felon. You are not, in fact, a criminal. But you do wear a uniform that says jail or prisoner on it. When you arrive, men and women, you will get used sheets. You will, if you're a woman, get underwear that is bloodstained. When you're on a period and you're a woman, you will not get more than one pad at a time. You will have to ask for one every time you need one. Sometimes, if you don't have a pad, well, there's no toilet paper either. There's nothing that you can really do but wait. Wait for a guard to get you some. Hence, the stained underwear. You do not have access to filtered water. The cups, in fact, are behind a locked door. And the water that you do have, that comes out of the faucet, tastes like chlorine and makes you sick, so you don't drink it. So, where am I? Yeah, it's the United States of America. Right here, right now, today, at this very moment. I want you all to just sit and think. I'm going to just give you another one of these, okay? Because I know I gave you a long list. But I need you to know, I need you to hear about something that is happening in our country, in our midst. What would happen if you were fed food with maggots? Uncooked chicken. And why? Because actually, if you serve food that's spoiled, it ends up being cheaper in the end. What would it be like to have to ask for a pad and maybe get one? What would it be like to want to complain, but there's no place to complain to? And actually, when you do complain, you worry about retribution. What does that retribution look like? Well, you know, when I told you about that, you're sent to a foreign country by mistake, that's a little bit about what retribution can look like. So, how did this happen? How many of you knew, honestly, that all of those things that I mentioned, how many of you, raise your hand if you knew that all of those things, every single one of them that I told you existed? A lot more than I expected then. Okay? I expected none of you to raise your hands. Because this is not a story that is told most often. It's not told because it's toxic. It's a toxic story to tell. It's a toxic issue. I don't quite know why, but toxic is the word that has come to me when I just think about why it is that we can't talk about this. We're not making stuff up here. There's no political agenda. I'm a fact-based journalist. That's what I do. So, how did this happen? Well, on a technical level, it's because of two things. I bet that many of you, although you are clearly a very smart audience, 1996 immigration reform, not 1986, which everybody knows, Immigration Reform and Control Act, IRCA, that big moment of amnesty, so-called amnesty. No, 1996, Bill Clinton in power, and the Republicans had taken the House and Senate. And that was when there was not a lot of worry about undocumented immigrants. Actually, immigration was not even kind of on the front burner. Well, this is when these reforms happened. That basically decided to put teeth into immigration. The sense was that, you know, the lax immigration laws had been lax, and there really needed to be a system of going and detaining people and searching them down and getting tough with the law. Something else happened, September 11th, which basically pushed a lot of these detention centers to be built pretty quickly because there was a sense that something had to happen. The laws were on the books, and now we just needed the spaces. Which brings me to a third thing that is not quite tied into it, but there were certainly people who understood what was happening here, which is the whole advent of private prisons. Immigrant detainees are the fastest growing use of private prisons in our country. So when you have a bed filled with a body, it equates into a profit for someone. Okay? So just picture that for a second when we think about capitalism, where everybody wants to increase their profits. That's what it's about. Geez, you know, even good old liberals and socialists that I know even want to increase their profits. So here we are talking about increasing your profits, and the way you do that is by increasing the number of people who you have in a bed. So it's beds and profits. Because you have investors and they want to get paid. Now we have to recognize we have the largest civil detention system in the world now exists in the United States. Right now, in the world. Now, Laureen, of course, Laureen Mills, gave me all kinds of information about Santa Fe. Like I said, I have my fetish. But now I also learned that right here we had internment camps right here in Santa Fe. So I think we have to have a conversation in our country about criminal corrections versus civil detention. There's a very big difference. There's a big difference. It's not the same thing. Who is being detained? Who exactly is being detained? We are told by the Obama administration that they are detaining the most serious criminals. Now everybody uses these terms, criminal aliens. You know, it was illegal aliens, it's criminal aliens. Now the term goes hand in hand. And that, when you do that kind of stuff and use that kind of language, leads to what I started off with, which is dehumanization. They're just the other. I mean, really, who cares how they're treated? They're different than us. They're not like us. They're others. They're illegal. Now, there was a moment a couple of years back when I actually did sit down and have an interview with your friend, Sheriff Joe Arpaio from the state over. And now, I have to say that I have done a lot of interviews in my life. I have interviewed, you know, skinheads and Aryan racists and, you know, CEOs and tough lawyers and people in, yeah, I know you just, I kind of threw that in there. You know, I have interviewed, but I have never really, I was bullied for a moment when I was covering the Elian situation down in Miami, and at that time I worked for CNN, and that was known as the Cuban News Network because Ted Turner liked Fidel, and so I was almost assaulted then by several elderly folks who were Cuban, who were not happy to see me there. But apart from that, I really have not been bullied. In almost every situation, interviewing gang members, everything, I really have not been bullied except for Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who was really having a grand time bullying me. And I I was kind of holding it all together because I was representing you. And I had you in my back pocket even then. Thank you. So I held it together. I was sweating tons. I was like, oh my God, it's going to look all watery, you know, because it is a visual medium. And, you know, and then at one point, Joe Arpaio, says, now, I use the term that they use. I would have used illegal alien just because I do that with people. I'll use their term mostly when I'm having a conversation. Well, today, for some reason, maybe because he was bullying me, I was just using the term undocumented immigrant. And so at one point in the interview, he just turns around and says, I got to ask you a question. How come you keep calling them undocumented immigrants, huh? And I was like, wait a second. Usually people aren't throwing questions at me. I'm the one throwing questions at them. What's happening? What? And then I was a little bit thrown off my game, and I just said, well, just answer. And so I said, Sheriff Joe, I said, do you know who Elie Wiesel is? And he was like, huh? And I said, Elie Wiesel, the Nobel Peace Prize winner. I said, survivor of the Holocaust. I said, well, actually, the reason why I use the term undocumented immigrant is because he was the one who told me that there is no such thing as an illegal human being. And once you label them illegal, illegal immigrants, illegal aliens, you have made them into an illegal people. They are the other. They are less than. And that's exactly how the Holocaust started. They began by calling the Jews illegal people. And so those are terms that are being used in our midst and that you probably use without even thinking. And I'm here to ask you to think about that. The next time you hear that, the next time it comes out of your mouth or the mouth of someone that you know, just say, maybe not. Maybe not that term. I bet many of you have heard another term that might be considered offensive at one point. It was called WAP. How many of you know that term? You're a WAP. Yeah, you know what it stands for, right? Without papers. That's what a WAP is. I know, you all just thought it was something that you said to Italians. It was without papers. So this term has existed long before us. So, you know, What do the American people want? What do they want? If this is it, well, then here we are, okay? We're people in immigrant detention facilities that are not supposed to be jails, but everything about them says that they're jails. And they're not criminal detainees, they are civil detainees. And where these people actually have less standards, fewer standards, they get worse treatment than the most hardened criminals at the Bureau of Prisons in our country. Please hear me when I'm telling you. The people in these detention facilities, the standards are not there. So if you're in a Bureau of Prison, you'd rather be there. Like the man who I met who was being deported from Miami back to the Dominican Republic and who had spent time in a Bureau of Prison in Pennsylvania. And he was like, BOP? I'm there. This stuff is crazy. What's happening now? So the problem is that, you see, usually we think that in our country, if you have some kind of treatment, there is recourse. There is legal recourse if you're abused. Usually in our country, there is legal recourse. We have rights. Guess what? There are no legal rights, no binding legal rights or standards for those who are detained in immigrant detention facilities in our country. None. None of the standards, wherever they may be, are legally binding at all. Wow. Think about that. Think about that. And you have a ready population. And you have basically a president and an administration that is very happy, proud of the numbers, the fact that deportations now are higher than they've ever been, and that detentions are just going up and up and up and up and up, and that they have quotas to meet. Now, is that who we are? You know, that maybe you just don't get daylight and you just don't get a phone call. Maybe that's where we are. I'm here to tell you that's where we are. So what does our president say? I don't think he's much of a leader on this. Nope, they are proud of the numbers. Enforcement proves to be a winner because that's what they say that Americans want. Enforcement, looking tough, doing something, cracking down on the problem. Because as long as there are undocumented people in our midst, there is a problem. And so they must be rounded up. And enforcement proves to be a winner. People like those numbers. I guess that's why the Obama administration is so intent on showcasing those numbers. Happily so. Wonderfully so. You'll see. So at what cost? Well, certainly the detention in and of itself comes at a cost of about $2 billion. Just the detention, okay? Detention. $2 billion a year. Now, the undocumented immigrants in our midst, in your midst, who are living in fear, they understand this. They understand that they are living in this country without papers. But the people who don't quite get it at all are the people, friends of yours, who you know. Yous, I was starting to get my Brooklyn thing going. Friends of yous, guys. You know, people who you know who live in this country with green cards. Right? And your friends with green cards, those of you who are in the audience with green cards, think you are safe. News for you, you're not safe. No. Not safe. Detention facilities filled with people with green cards who have been here 20 or 30 years. Not safe. No joke. Mandatory detention. Mandatory. Okay? Now, Mark Krikorian from Washington, D.C., who is anti-immigrant, says, you know what? Look, immigration was something that was happening when our country was young. It was our adolescent period. We're more sophisticated and advanced now. We're done with that kind of thing. Okay. He says, over and done with. Done. So, okay, fine, Mark Krikorian. I'd like us to have a national conversation about this so that we can think about the Statue of Liberty, what it says, who we are as a country. But you can't just decide that your think tank says, okay, we're done with that adolescent period in America of, oh, being so open to all those people. It's done. Well, no. I actually believe that Americans care. I believe that many of them just don't know. And they don't know because the media doesn't tell. And the media doesn't tell because immigration is a toxic issue. Unless, of course, you're Lou Dobbs, although it did turn out to be a toxic issue for him at CNN, cost them $8 million, and the credibility of their network, and having to like reach over, bend over backwards to see if they can get a Latino audience that I hope doesn't deliver for them. Because what was it about for Lou Dobbs? What was it about? Money. Yeah. It wasn't about making money for CNN. It was about making more money. CNN makes money. They wanted more money. They wanted to get into the ratings battle with Fox. And so that's why. That's why Lou Dobbs was there doing his shtick. Doing his shtick. Yeah, Lou Dobbs. Now, for me to talk about immigration, frankly, it's a toxic issue. Again, I use that word because, you know, the assumption is that I have an agenda, that because I was born in Mexico and because I've always been open about the fact that I kind of can't hide the Maria Hinojosa thing, although, boy, have people called me and just been like, can you change your name already? Like, can you Americanize it? And I'm just like, how do you want me to? You know, is it Hinojosa? What is it? Doesn't kind of roll off my tongue, but eh. So people think that I have an agenda. But here's the coolest thing about it is that, yeah, I have an agenda because I'm an American citizen. Because I actually made a choice to become an American citizen. And so I had to think long and hard about that. I had to rescind my Mexican citizenship. And I had to think long and hard about that, and I did. And I did. I took the little test. I went in, took my vows, the whole thing. Did it. I did it. So it means something to me, you know? It really does. Like when I talk about democracy with my kids, they understand that it's not just about going to the polling booth. It's also about seeing what democracy looks like on the street. And unfortunately, as a journalist, I do not go to demonstrations unless I'm covering them. So that's the hard part about being a mom, because I feel like part of what democracy looks like, not part, an essential part of what democracy looks like is also that, is congregating in groups, in public, outside, being seen, a community, voicing, not just social media. What happened in Egypt, it wasn't because people were just like typing. They were out on the street. That's what democracy looks like, okay? So I take this very seriously, and I believe that what I do and the fact that my family suffers about the fact that they never see their mom and the wife, that I should be there, is because I'm doing this as a civic duty for you. For you, and I do it with con todo corazón. Believe me, I would so love to be retired about now. I swear, I'm tired. But I do this because I know that there are young journalists who are saying, she's doing it. And so I don't give up. I swear. I really would love to just like be looking at the ocean. And seriously, I could use that. But we need to see this in this moment. We need to. And for some reason, I am lucky enough to be able to get there inside. And in that sense, thank you to the Obama administration that they did open up, that the Department of Homeland Security opened up and let us in. At least that is true. We are there. And they sat down with us. So thank you. Because that is an essential part, the transparency. Letting us see. So, yeah, I became an American. And so I was given this award. I know you guys are going to be like, what? She was given the Outstanding American by Choice, the ABC Award, the Outstanding American by Choice Award. And guess who gave me the award and guess where? Well, it was given on Ellis Island at a citizenship swearing-in for about this many people on Ellis Island. How cool. And guess who gave me the award? Gave me the award! Secretary Janet Napolitano. And she listened as I told my new citizens that what I learned as a Mexicana in this country, watching the media, watching 60 Minutes, and I hope they hire me one day too, is that part of the essential role of a democracy is also to have not only an engaged public, but to have a free media, a press that can question and critique, and that is an essential part of what we do. And Janet Napolitano listened and smiled throughout my entire speech. I swear, I am not lying. Okay, it is true. So, I just don't understand how much more we can take of this. Because in the wake of this inertia of policy decisions, in this wake of a lack of leadership, in this wake of laws that are coming, that are ripping our country apart, there are human lives in this wake. There are human laws. Lives, I mean. Human lives. And I know that the Obama administration says one thing, that they're not for family separation, but the reality is that there is no protocol. There is no protocol for any of these people who are going and detaining immigrants, going into their homes at 6 in the morning and taking them out here and there, and maybe you don't even know it's happening in your community because it happens at 6 in the morning, and there's so much shame involved. There is so much shame. But never at that moment is there any protocol about asking this person who is now detained, do you have American-born children? Because that might matter. That might matter because then that person who's going to be put in a detention center that is basically a tent, okay, where you're not supposed to be held for more than a couple of weeks, suddenly you're held there for 2 years because you're going to fight your case because you have American citizen children. And that is costing you and me $122 per day, per head. Okay? Because that's the way they talk about it. Per head. The government is paying to the private detention facility. And how much is he actually spending on that detainee? Well, I talked about the food with maggots because it saves money. So you get the picture. But we're paying $122 per head to now detain the largest group of detainees ever. How do you feel about that? Not me. How do you feel about that? What are you going to do about that? How much are you going to talk about that? It's not about me. It's about you. I will need your help. Yes, let me tell you, I will need your help because they will come after me. Definitely. So please become my friends on Facebook, please, or something like that, or Twitter, or whatever you choose, because then you'll know when the documentary is coming out and you can watch it. Yeah, it's not going to be pretty. But the thought that I want to leave you with is this. What does it mean that right now, in our country, someone can be denied basic due process? A human being can be denied due process in our country. What does it mean if that can happen within our borders? I guess I'll just leave you with the thought that by a strange moment of fate that I would end up reporting this story and at the same time being asked to go to the Dominican Republic to report this other story about within this island, Dominicans on this side of the island deporting Haitians to this side of the island. There's a long history of hatred and distrust between Haiti and the Dominican Republic, even though they're in the same geographic space. It's long and it's ugly. It involves takeovers and massacres. But the fact is that right now, that's happening. And I don't know, you know, if the United States is supposed to be the model of a free democracy, then why shouldn't the Dominican Republic be doing that and be denying citizenship to children of undocumented immigrants that are born there and rounding up people at 6 a.m? And they don't have camps, but they do just drive you and deport you. Well, why not? Why not call them illegal anyway? Because the world's greatest democracy does. Why can't we? It's a wonderful thing to be a role model for the rest of the world, isn't it? Right? So I hope that you will listen to that report on Latino USA this week, and I think it's going to be on Need to Know on Friday night. Need to Know that replaced Our Beloved Now on PBS. Oh, Our Beloved Now on PBS. How much we love it and miss it. But so be it. It changed our lives. I'm going to leave you with one upbeat story, and then we can sit down and talk. I love this story. It's not quite, well, it sort of follows through, but I love this story. And it'll make you smile, and that'll make you feel good. So during September 11th, I was working at CNN in New York, and it was definitely the story that I never thought I would ever have to cover. And it was really, really shocking. Yeah, definitely not pretty. But within 2 days, a day actually after September 11th, I knew that there were undocumented immigrants. And again, many of you know that I try to give voice to the voiceless, to the most invisible. And, you know, as my husband says, you find the saddest country, the poorest country, and inside the poorest country and the saddest country, you find the poorest and saddest people and talk to them. And I'm like, you're right, it's true. And he's like, I just want you to be happy. And I'm like, I'm trying, honey. But after September 11th, you know, I knew that there were undocumented immigrants, and so we went out and we did a story of undocumented, a man, Antonio Melendez, who worked at Windows on the World, and we went to find his family, Julia Hernandez and her 4 children, 3 of which were U.S. citizens, and 1 of which was undocumented, like Julia. And we put this story on the air on CNN, and really the response was quite wonderful to have people from Kansas and Oklahoma and, you know, Oregon sending her little cards of, you know, thank you and good wishes. And in December of 2001, a couple of months after 9/11, I get a phone call, and on the other end of the line is somebody who answers like this, hi, is this Maria Hanojosa? And I was like, Inojosa, yeah. Hi, Ms. Hanojosa, listen, my name is AJ Dinkins, and I'm originally from Augusta, Maine. No, I'm originally from South Carolina, but I live in Augusta, Maine now, and I have a beauty salon, and my partner Rudy and I, in our church, we just raised several $1,000s for Julia Hernandez and the Hernandez children. And so I'd like to come down to New York, Ms. Hanojosa, and deliver these gifts to the Hernandez family, but I've never been to New York, and I've never been to the Bronx where she lives. Would you please, Miss Inojosa, come and get me from the airport on Sunday? And I said, AJ, listen, I'm going to come and get you from the airport on Sunday, But I'm coming with a camera crew because I'm going to do the story of the day that the gay hairdresser from Maine came to deliver gifts of love to the September 11th undocumented Mexican immigrant family from the Bronx. So, no, it's a true story. True story, actual true story. So AJ came down on Sunday, and, you know, he's a hairdresser, so he had dyed his hair red, because, of course, that's what he does. It was Christmas time, so Santa Claus. And we take him up to the Bronx, and AJ had, this is 2001, Augusta, Maine, so the Mexicans had not arrived in New York, in Maine yet. They're there now, but back then they weren't. So, you know, AJ had never met any Mexicanos, period. And Julia had never met a white gay man that she didn't work for. So it was an interesting union there. And I didn't know what to expect, but you know what? It was a love fest. It was just a total love fest. And everybody just got together and just loved each other. And AJ gave gifts to all the kids. And they didn't understand each other because AJ doesn't speak Spanish and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And as AJ was leaving, he was like, oh, I love this family so much. I want to invite them to my farm in Augusta, Maine. And I just thought, we'll see if that ever happens. Well, you know, fast forward 6 months, it's July of 2002, and the 1 year anniversary of September 11th is around the corner, and phone rings, and it's like, AJ, hey, Maria, listen, I want you to pack up your husband and kids and come on up to my house, because I've just invited Julia Hernandez, her 4 kids, plus a cousin to come and spend a week at my farm, and I want you to join me. And I said, AJ, I will be there. And I'm not bringing my husband or my kids, but I'm bringing a camera crew. Because I'm going to be there to tell the story of the gay hairdresser and his partner, Rudy the farmer, who invited the undocumented immigrant family to their home in Maine for a week. And so we went up to Maine. Now, I had never been to Maine in the summertime. And boy, the bushes really know what they're talking about. That Maine is like, woof, it's beautiful in the summertime. My God. But at that time, it was a little homogeneous. And so I don't know if you can imagine that there's Rudy with blonde hair, AJ with blonde hair, Rudy 6 feet tall wearing overalls because he's a farmer, Julia, her 4 kids plus the cousin, myself, my cameraman, a hippie with the ponytail, and my African-American sound tech. And, you know, we were just in downtown Augusta, Maine, like having the time of our lives, and everybody's like, who are these people? What are they doing together? And why do they look so happy? What is going on here? We don't understand this. And of course, all of us were there to make the children happy because we wanted them to not have to be thinking about the 1 year anniversary of their dad dying on September 11th. And the fact that their mom was still undocumented and so was their brother, and so therefore their lives were completely unsure, even though they had a father who died an American hero. And so we did a wonderful story, and it was really moving. And as I was leaving, I asked AJ, you know, what made him do this? And he said, you know what, it was special for me to invite them, but it was really truly special for Julia to say thank you and accept the invitation and put herself outside of her comfort zone. And that's, in a way, what I'm asking all of you to do at every moment in your lives, is to think about being the other, is to think about living your life like the other in our United States day after day. Because Julia did that. She took her kids to the family of a gay couple that she didn't know. And AJ opened his house to a bunch of Mexicans that he barely knew, who then, by now, really were American kids. And they all got along famously. And my image of who we are as the United States of America is a photograph of me, AJ, and Julia. AJ with in the middle with his American flag t-shirt, and on either side, me and Julia in Maine. And that's my America. Thank you so much. Thank you. 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 Oh my God. Thank you.